Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Woodstock. It's the 55th anniversary of the Woodstock Music and Art Fair this weekend. And in addition to the peace, love, and music on that rainy weekend in 1969 at Yasgur's Farm, there was mud, and lots of it. Jason Dole takes a deep dive into the mud of Woodstock. Plus, investigative journalist Nina Burley and her debut novel, Zero Visibility Possible, explores a mass public trauma you'll most likely remember, and the uses to which bad actors will put such events. We'll speak to her live. And Elder Justice Day in Pike County is coming up, educating seniors. And it's Canal Fest in Wayne County this weekend. It's all coming up. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The health ministry in Gaza says more than 40,000 Palestinians have now been killed by Israeli attacks since October 7th. The war in Gaza began when Hamas militants attacked Israel, killing about 1,200 people and abducting scores of others. The news comes as a new round of ceasefire talks are to open in Qatar today. Hamas is not sending representatives. It says it has already submitted a counterproposal. Israel is sending officials. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more.
The stakes are very high, especially for the more than 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza under dire conditions with daily fatalities from Israeli airstrikes, and also for the remaining Israeli hostages. They're languishing and possibly even dying in captivity in Gaza. You know, these are all people who don't have days and weeks to wait.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reporting. President Biden and Vice President Harris will make their first formal joint appearance today in Maryland since Biden ended his reelection bid. NPR's Windsor Johnston has more.
The question is to what extent President Biden can be an asset to Harris in the weeks leading up to the election and in what ways. Amani Cheers is with the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University.
He has opportunities to not only secure his legacy, but to remind voters about not only what he promised, but what he's been able to do over the last three and a half years and what he can continue to do.
Harris and Biden are expected to talk up the steps they've taken and what they still plan to do to lower costs for Americans, specifically the price of health care, housing, child care, and education. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Republican vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance says he is willing to meet his Democratic opponent, Tim Walz, for a debate on October 1st. It's to be on CBS. Vance also says he accepts another debate on September 18th on CNN. People are still shopping and spending money despite high inflation. That's according to new numbers from the Commerce Department. It's also reporting stronger than expected retail sales. NPR's Maria Aspen reports the Dow rose about 400 points in early trading.
There's more good news about the U.S. economy. Shoppers are spending more. In the latest evidence, consumers are feeling less pressure from inflation. The Commerce Department finds retail sales rose 1% in July. That's much better than expected and much stronger growth than in June. Walmart is adding to that retail optimism. The country's largest retailer reported strong growth in its quarterly sales and profit and raised its forecasts for the rest of the year. There's also good news on the labor front. New applications for unemployment benefits fell last week. As of late July, 1.9 million people were receiving some form of jobless aid. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR. Paramount Television Studios will be shutting down at the end of the week. NPR's Eric Deggans reports it's a cost-cutting move by the studio's parent company amid a downturn in traditional broadcast and cable TV.
Once the studio behind TV shows like 13 Reasons Why and Watchmen, Paramount TV Studios also developed a number of television shows connected to film franchises made by the Paramount Movie Studio, including Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan and The Offer, about the making of The Godfather. But after the studio shut down, projects under development and ongoing shows, like Prime Video's Reacher, will move to CBS Studios. Paramount executives told staff in memos the shutdown is part of an effort to streamline the company. Paramount Global executives have outlined a plan to cut $500 million in costs ahead of an announced merger with Skydance Productions. Eric Deggans, NPR News.
Forecasters say Hurricane Ernesto is moving north in the Atlantic Ocean. It's getting stronger, too, with top sustained winds of 85 miles per hour. It's expected to hit the island of Bermuda this weekend. Ernesto swept by Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, triggering flash flooding. Japan has dropped its advisory about a potential mega earthquake that could possibly strike the country on its Pacific coast. There were fears that a quake with a magnitude of 8 or even 9 could happen, triggering a catastrophic tsunami that could hit Japan's eastern coast. The advisory was initially released a week ago, following an earthquake with a magnitude of 7.1 that caused no deaths or severe damage. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include BritBox, dedicated to helping people discover British crime series, including new seasons of Silent Witness, Blue Lights, and The Responder, starring Martin Freeman. Streaming at BritBox.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Woodstock's anniversary, the 55th, is this weekend, the 55th anniversary of the Woodstock Music and Art Fair. To see the epic performances at Woodstock, attendees endured crowds, rain, minimal food and water, and lots of mud. Jason Dole took a deep dive into the mud of Woodstock, and he joins us this morning. Hello.
Hey there. As you can see, I'm still stained a bit red because there's a lot of iron oxide in the soil at Woodstock. I brought some soil here.
There's a dirt sample right here in front of us. Yes.
Official from Bethel Woods, Museum of Bethel Woods. Talk about the mud.
We're talking about the mud. Here's how History.com said this about Woodstock in their entry online. Often lost in the haze of 1960s nostalgia is the fact that Woodstock, while undoubtedly a once-in-a-century cultural happening, was also a traffic-snarled, rain-soaked, mud-caked mess.
Yeah.
So we're talking about all the mud and the memories of the mud in this report you did. Tell us a little bit about what you discovered.
You cannot tell the story of Woodstock without talking about the mud. And then what we realize is that for some attendees, it's a key part, a core memory of their experience. And what we did is we dived into the oral histories here, and we actually hear from some of the attendees, as well as us doing some analysis and thinking about the mud.
All right. Jason Dole, investigative journalist with the mud of Woodstock.
You've probably heard the phrase sex, drugs, and rock and roll, a trio of things that sums up a single hedonistic approach to life in the late 20th century. 100 years earlier, it was wine, women, and song. And 2,000 years before that, a Roman might have said balnea vina venus, or baths, wine, and sex, because that's how exciting bathing was in Rome. But at the Woodstock Music and Arts Fair in Bethel, New York, August 1969, the three words that sum up the approach to life in that place at that moment became peace, love, and music. 3 days of it. And although sex, drugs, wine, and even bathing were all part of Woodstock, if you ask people what they associate with the famous festival, peace, love, and music probably take the top three spots. But then, what's number four? What's the next most remembered thing about Woodstock? I think it might be the mud. And I'm not alone.
So this is, I would start here. This can be the first, this is how you can start the podcast.
This is Dr. Neil V. Hitch, senior curator at the Museum of Bethel Woods on the historic site of the 1969 Woodstock Music and Arts Fair. He's thumbing through a stack of transcripts from Bethel Woods' Oral History Project. Since 2020, Hitch and his team have been gathering the stories of Woodstock from the people who were there, and they're preserving them.
So I did this interview with a gentleman this year in Santa Fe. And sometimes what I ask people is like, when you close your eyes and think about Woodstock, what's your vivid memory? Like, what's the thing that sticks out?
So you're saying if you close your eyes and put yourself there, what pops out?
Yeah. So this guy says, it's the sound of the mud.
And the sound of the mud as you took off your boots, or you didn't take off your boots right away, but you realized that was the way to go. And the mud had this very profound sucking sound, which permeated my consciousness.
That's Owen Lipstein, recorded during his oral history interview. And he just said the sound of the mud permeated his consciousness. The mud is a core memory.
A lot of people have memories of Woodstock that are oh, I remember Santana, and oh, I remember this. But that's not how memories work, right? Our memories are very specific. It's how we know something happened. And usually it's a very, very personal memory of something that you can't get out of your head, right? That's how your brain works.
That almost becomes profound in that sense. It's a real sensory experience, and not the sense you would think would be affected by mud. He's talking about the sound as much as the feeling of it.
Yeah. And then what he says is...
Gradually you start to hear the music.
But the mud started immediately?
All I can say is that's my first almost palpable central memory. How quickly it started after I crossed what I remember to be a fence or a barrier, I don't recall. I just remember thinking, holy shit. But the sound was like music in my ears.
The sound was like music in my ears.
That's deep. That's great.
That's the vivid Woodstock memory. It's not the music of Santana. It's the music of the mud. I'm showing you this picture. An attendee named Richard Gordon took this picture. And when you ask about mud, for me, it starts here. Because, I mean, this is a picture of somebody's bare feet standing in mud that's also like trampled in mown grass or hay almost. And like the top, his feet are muddy, right? Like he's been walking through this mud. And I think to myself, why did somebody take that picture? Like you're at Woodstock. You have 450,000 people, already these amazing bands on stage. You're hanging out with all your friends. And like you look down and shoot a picture of your feet standing in a muddy field, there's zero context. That's all it is. If you didn't know that, if that was not in a Woodstock file, there'd be no way to know that was Woodstock. But that's Yasgur Field. That's the field right there.
Yeah, you could see it just as you described it. It's there's the mud. There's the feet are just in the upper third of it, and the whole rest of the square is just this muddy piece of field. And you're almost seeing equal amounts of wet earth as well as straw and grass. Like it really does look like a farmer's field.
Yeah, it almost looks like an art piece, right? Yeah. Like you've created this composition because it's also square, and it's like created a composition to be on an art wall. And this is just like in a random file in a random collection of random photos from Woodstock.
This speaks to how prominent the mud experience was at Woodstock, that somebody would take a picture of it. But maybe it also tells us something about what the hundreds of thousands who came here were looking for. I mean, part of this was marketed to young people that were, mostly in urban and suburban areas and saying, hey, get out to the country, as the young people would say today, like touch grass.
Yeah. Yes. And like seeing music in the garden, let's say, right? I mean, that's what was talked about in the pastoral complex of the virgin, farm areas of the United States, where you're just like it is the Garden of Eden, right? Isn't that why they say we got to get back to the garden? It's a reference to the Garden of Eden. Right.
There's a sense of primacy, like origin, whether it's a Garden of Eden or like a Garden of Origin. It's that whole thing. We get back to the earth. And this is almost like a selfie. It's saying, hey, I did it. I'm here. I'm here on the earth.
Though it's also opposite of that, because literally he's standing in a sea of horse manure and chicken manure and right. And hay. And I'm surprised everyone. We didn't have 450,000 people with cholera. That's what's surprising.
So, I mean, in your capacity here, how often does the mud turn up in narratives or in recollections or even in the collection?
It turns up occasionally. So everyone experienced it. That's what I guess I would say. But there are maybe a few people that have it as their biggest, most vivid memory.
Okay, this is where we have to pause and point out that the mud also contributed to some of the more negative memories of Woodstock and some of the more painful experiences. Because with hundreds of thousands of attendees, there were plenty of medical issues at Woodstock,
Dr. William Abruzzi was hired by Woodstock Ventures to oversee medical care at the festival, and as the event ballooned to the size of a very muddy city, many local doctors and nurses were flown in to help. And Abruzzi's medical report shows that the number one injury sustained at Woodstock was foot lacerations, 836 of them. That's more than the number of recorded overdoses at the festival, which is saying something when you're talking about Woodstock. Here's attendee Christine Caccio recalling her foot injury.
I got in a trailer. A doctor or whoever saw my foot. They wrapped it in a... They put a plastic bag over it, washed it, put a plastic bag over it, taped it around my ankle, and gave me a tetanus shot. And that's, I was pretty worried about that too. I'm thinking, oh, shit, something's in this tetanus shot. I guess I was a little scared.
Now, Christine didn't mention exactly what cut her foot, but Neil Hitch has an example of the primary culprit of most of the Woodstock foot injuries right there in the museum at Bethel Woods. They have a lot of them in the collection, in fact.
I'm going to show you this artifact that looks like it's a precious piece of jewelry, right? You see it?
Embedded in a piece of foam.
Yeah, so it can't move. And what is it?
It's an old can pull tab that they used to have before the safety tabs.
Like, seriously, that is a piece of garbage, right? But the garbage, the pull tabs here are precious. What do we know about Woodstock? What happens to the pull tabs when they're left on the ground?
It becomes the number one cause of foot injuries.
Yeah. And so if you think about that, you have all this new technology, which is basically, let me pull this piece of very, very sharp metal off of this can and throw it on the ground. And so that was solved from, you know, but you have this period that where every can has a pull tab. That period also aligns with Woodstock.
And those pull tabs did not work alone in giving attendees foot lacerations. Their accomplice? The mud. Because as much as there's a popular image of barefoot hippies at Woodstock, the fact is most of the attendees weren't hippies, but they were just suburban young people from New Jersey, Long Island, the Hudson Valley, who didn't know much about camping out on a farmer's field. But they did know enough to not show up barefoot. Everybody came with shoes on, but when the field turned into a very sticky clay mud, it sucked the shoes right off of people's feet, leaving them susceptible to foot injuries.
This is another oral history from a gentleman named Harvey Greenwald. He was on site as a vendor.
The booth was quite nice, and we had loads of people come by it, as you can see, barefoot in the mud, but it was very bad for business.
The mud was bad for business?
No, the location.
And he just tells a story, this one thing that's just weird. And then I looked across the field, and there was this huge crowd of people covered in mud.
It turned out they were all totally naked, covered in mud. I referred to them in my mind as the mud people. And they started to come across the field. They were so, like, baked in mud. And guys, girls, it was even hard to determine ages or anything. You know, and they moved across the field as it started to rain again a little bit. And the motorcycle guy, who just stood there with their mouths open. They'd never seen anything like it. And I saw this girl, she had two leg braces on at the foot of the hill. I was on the rise, way up above the amphitheater, because that became a mudslide all the way down. You couldn't walk anymore, you slid. You see people playing like that in various movies I've seen, but that's because it was almost unwalkable in spots from the rain. And this girl had two leg braces on and two canes, and she's fighting to go up, and she keeps slipping face down in the mud. And I noticed that the people who were around were so engrossed just looking at the stage or listening or carrying on. I didn't see anyone helping her, and it was starting to disturb me a lot. So I said to these girls, would you please watch my stuff? I'll give you each a headband. Oh, yeah, just watch the stuff so it, you know, just doesn't walk away. And I slid down. I started to walk down, but I slid down. And I started pushing her up the hill. and we kept falling down and falling down. I was soaking wet by the time we got to the top. You know, I couldn't believe it, you know. We're there, you know, like I was raising the flag on Suribachi or something. And there, excuse me, as soon as I get there, she says to me, "Hey, man, I can't thank you enough. You want some drugs?" I said, no, that's okay. And she started yelling out, "Acid, pot." She was fighting her way up to the top there so she could sell drugs. It's a great image. You wouldn't forget. I don't think you want to print that, but I don't think you'd ever forget it.
The mud is a vivid, vivid memory. So this is a person, Elizabeth Donnelly Nelson, and she's a question about mud, and she's asked a question about, I have some more questions. I want to know about your story about the mud. It's actually really funny to me that we're talking about that because we're currently working on a project with a local radio station that's doing a story of mud at Woodstock. So this is just like from 2 days ago.
Oh, that's referencing this project here.
Yeah.
That's great. Oh, cool. And then she has something to say about the mud?
She does. Great. So she says like...
Years later, I had a dream and I was talking to a fellow artist and I was saying... You know, Woodstock was not pleasant. Basically, it was muddy. It was not a pleasant place at the time. But I still don't remember that. That was just a dream I had. And I thought, yeah, I guess it wasn't, you know, all it cracked up to be. It was a muddy mess. But we persevered. The music was there. The people were just, you know, friendly as can be. I remember people along the aisles sliding in the mud, going shooting down the aisles like, you know, just sliding, you know, doing belly flops or whatever, sliding through the mud because it was a lot of it. The mud, it was wet. It was rainy. But you know what? It was something we persevered through and it was fine. You know, we were there until Monday morning. Early when Jimi Hendrix performed and everything. And on my way out, I picked up this program. It was in the mud, so it's got the mud on it. It's the Woodstock program. You know, when I got home, he had lots of mud on everything I have. And I remember I was wearing a leather suede fringe jacket, wasn't really conducive to all the rain, and I had an old football blanket that I made into a poncho, and they were all caked with mud, and I threw it all into the bathtub when I got home and just rinsed off the mud, which too bad I could have kept that as a relic. But I did pick up some mud. I got some mud from Woodstock, and there's some of the Woodstock mud. I didn't think that it would be a keepsake, really, but just I kept it anyway.
So in some ways, the people going through the mud, to the extent that they do mention it, in some ways it almost seems like a badge of honor.
Yeah, it is. Like, that's the memory. Is it the memory because, like, you had to deal with it when you got home? Or is it the memory because, like, on that Sunday when you're sliding in the mud, like, you get to the point, and a lot of people who give oral histories talk about this. You get to the point where it just doesn't matter. And it's not like it's just happening to you. It's happening to everyone. Like, everyone is wet. Everyone is muddy. Everyone is sitting here listening to this amazing music. So you might as well, like, who cares? This is just what it is.
And one of the big takeaways of Woodstock that we hear from people was that it was a moment where they realized they weren't alone. There was people that might have been a little different in their own towns or high schools and their suburbs and New Jersey or Long Island. But then they came out here and they said, there's a lot more of us than I thought. In some ways, the mud, I mean, the rain and the whole experience of the mud's part of that is it's another unifier.
Yeah. People talk about it being a unifier, that it's the great equalizer. I think somebody says that in like one of the documentaries or something.
Mud is a great equalizer.
Yeah.
And
this is youth culture looking for their own identity, looking to make their moment, their mark in the world. And one of the ways that they started to distinguish themselves from the other generation would be things like clothes or length of hair. Yeah. The willingness to get muddy, you know, almost seems to be another one of those signifiers.
Yeah. And I think the thing that everyone, like, it's the thing that everyone has in common, other than the big things they all have in common, which is either the music or Vietnam, right?
Yeah.
But it's the thing that goes home with you too, right? That's really interesting. I've never really think about that. But the mud is what goes home with you more, almost more than the memory, because you get home and you have to deal with it. Jim Shelley has this really funny story. He's got a whole story. He says he's a docent here. You can come get a docent tour from him. And he will go through his whole story about being here. But the funniest thing is the last thing he said when I did an oral history with him, which is he came here with a sleeping bag. Sleeping bag kind of kept him out of the mud, right? They got soaking wet after the rain. He turned to his friend. He said, like, are you ready? He says, yeah, let's go. So they pack up and go home. He walks in the door of his house, and the only thing his mother says is, I'm not cleaning that sleeping bag.
Reporting for Radio Catskill's Woodstock Mud Bureau, I'm Jason Dole.
Excellent reporting, Jason Dole. Thank you for that. And as part of their oral history initiative, Bethel Woods Museum curators are traveling the country and across New York State to capture the unique stories of Woodstock, with an overall goal of collecting 4,500 Woodstock stories from people who attended the festival. You heard some of those in that report from Jason. And that number, 4,500 stories, that's only 1% of those who found their way to Yasgur's Farm for the festival. There is an oral history appointment opportunity this weekend, Saturday, August 17th, at the Conneaugh Lake, New York Farmers Market. You can get more information about that and register at BethelWoodsCenter.org. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Elder Justice Day in Pike County. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Thursdays at 9, it's Connect the Dots with me, David Christian. It's the freeform show where each song leads to the next by way of a musical connection. Think of it as a dive into music's liner notes, exploring the behind-the-scenes connections that show that the distance between genres and decades is often shorter than we think. That's Connect the Dots, Thursday nights at 9, here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Listen local.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Elder Justice Day is held annually by the Pike County Area Agency on Aging, gathering professionals from across the state to educate older adults on various topics related to aging. This year's event is Tuesday, August 20th at the Matamoras Senior Center in Matamoras, Pennsylvania, and it centers around self-care. Here to tell us more is Tracy Simon, Protective Services Supervisor for the Pike County Area Agency on Aging. Tracy, good morning.
Good morning.
And I wanted to ask you about just the name Elder Justice Day. It's been going on for, I think, what, 10 years now. That's an empowering sort of title. How did you guys come up with that idea versus something like, you know, Senior Day?
It's a chance to empower our elders, especially when they're victims of abuse, neglect, or exploitation. So we want to give them the resources to control being a victim. So that's where the Elder Justice Day term came from, as part of the Elder Task Force that Pike County has, which is a collaboration of professionals in Pike County that mainly deal with seniors as part of their profession.
And this year's Elder Justice Day, coming up on Tuesday, centers around self-care. And that's something that the folks in the community had said that they wanted to discuss. Is that how this topic came about this year?
It was a combination of that, as well as we've seen an increase of the number of reports we've received in our protective service unit that are based upon self-neglect. And we feel that number increased due to COVID. So due to the isolation, the not being able to come to our senior centers, you know, the fear of going to a store out in the community because their immune system may be compromised, they're older, they didn't want to get sick, and in return, they didn't realize they were neglecting themselves. So we're trying to focus on avoiding the self-neglect and letting them learn, like, self-care is good. Here's what the communities have to offer. Come back to our senior centers. Come, you know, get out with your friends and family. You know, make sure you get to your doctor's appointments. If you're not feeling well, you know, if there's a problem, let them identify it so they don't get into a situation where we can't help them. And it, you know, sometimes it's terminal or deadly.
We mentioned that there are professionals from across the Keystone State helping with these presentations. Can you highlight some of the folks that will be there and some of the topics they're discussing?
Sure. So we have a attorney, William Onofre, who the seniors love. So he comes in and talks a lot about legal matters. So whether it's, you know, setting up a power of attorney, your living will, your last rights. So he wants the seniors to know sometimes a choice that they may think is appropriate might not be appropriate, which may lead to additional victimization, such as exploitation, which may lead to them having, you know, no income. So it's almost like a dominoes effect. We also have the Attorney General's office will be speaking. They deal a lot with scams. They, protecting your money, investments. You know, we see a lot of scams in Pike County, whether it's romance scams, malware scams, Microsoft scams, you know, fake checks, that kind of stuff. Seniors don't know. Oh, I got a message on my phone. My Amazon package is delayed. Let me click on it. The next thing you know, their account is wiped out.
Yeah,
and we also have our local victims intervention program is coming to speak about domestic violence and people 60 and over, because people don't understand that you can be a victim of domestic violence no matter what age, and that includes 60 and over. And there has been an increase of people who have been abused, whether it's by a loved one, a family member, a partner. So we're trying to educate them on things that affect them personally so they can protect themselves.
And local organizations are going to be there too, including the Drug Take Back program. Can you explain what that's about?
Sure. So between the Pike County Sheriff's Department and our local Carbon Monroe Pike Drug and Alcohol, if anybody has any used medications that they want to dispose of, we take them back on that day. They're disposed of properly. So any, you know, narcotics, general medication, anything that's expired, they get to dump them in a container and they're exposed on site. And they also have the opportunity to take home a smaller version of that liquid, that if they have medications at home, they can destroy them at home safely without having somebody else get a hold of them or just throwing them in the garbage.
And you're looking for folks to register for the event, right?
Correct. So registration ends Friday around 4 o'clock. So they can call our office at 570-77-550-550 and register with our office. If you're a senior in Pike County, you can call the transportation and sign up for the share ride so that you can have transportation to and from the event.
And there's more information at that phone number, or also, is there a website as well?
I believe it's up on the website.
Yeah. Okay, good. And
Pike County Aging. And we have various vendors coming from within Pike County, home health agencies, durable medical equipment, nursing homes. So there's a lot of, about 20 vendors who will be there with different aspects of services or things for the seniors to ask questions about. And there's a light breakfast and lunch provided and door prizes throughout the day.
All right. We've been talking to Tracy Simon, Protective Services Supervisor for the Pike County Area Agency on Aging, about Elder Justice Day coming up Tuesday, the 20th in Matamoros. Its mission is to educate the public on recognizing and preventing and reporting cases of elder abuse. And if you know or suspect an elderly person is being harmed, contact the Pike County Elder Abuse Task Force, 800-490-8505. Reports are taken 24 hours a day. Tracy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, investigative journalist Nina Burley and her debut novel. That's after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, this is Jeff, your host on Radio Catskill's show, Electric Mountain. I'll be playing a choice selection of house, techno, electro, and a whole lot more. And every week, I'll feature a guest DJ spinning a continuous set, bringing their unique style. Come dance with us on Electric Mountain, each and every Saturday night, 12 to 2, exclusively done on Radio Catskill. Listen, local.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we've got the return of hippie food. It's delicious this time, with cookbook author Jess Dammit. And we get mind-blowing, simple cooking tips from one of our favorite chefs, North Carolina's own Ashley Christensen. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11, on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Nina Burley is a journalist, best-selling author, documentary producer, and publisher of a Substack on politics called American Freak Show. Her debut novel, Zero Visibility Possible, is based on the true story of the 2017 mass shooting in Las Vegas, and it's been described as, quote, a dark satire about American violence and media and the lure of conspiracy thinking. Nina Burley joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. And we also have culture reporter Valerie Manzi here with us as well, because you and Valerie were scheduled to talk yesterday, but we had some funniness with our phones. And so we're doing it live. So, Valerie, take it away.
And welcome back to WJFF Radio Catskill. It's been a while. And I see that you've been a busy beaver as usual. And you have a dystopian thriller that just came out. And my first question is, why did an investigative reporter, nonfiction writer, move to fiction?
Well, it's great to be here live with you, Valerie. Thanks for having me. Well, I'm an English major, and I always wanted to write fiction. I thought when I graduated from college many years ago that I was going to be the great American novelist. And I went off to make money, because I wasn't going to make money writing fiction, and I actually wasn't writing anything yet. And I went to cover the State House in Springfield, Illinois. That was my first job in journalism. And I basically got addicted to current events and being in the thick of the action. And I loved the lifestyle of journalism, sitting in the chair writing, but then getting up and going out and seeing the world all over. But I never really lost my interest in literature. And I actually think that, especially after the last 6 or 8 years, in my career, in which the rise of Trump and the sort of affiliated mayhem and chaos, and the speeding up of the sort of cycle of events in our world, has certainly left a lot of us in the journalism business pretty addled, I would say, or just made our lives more difficult. But it's also, I think, made it very difficult for the public to understand what's really happening in the world. And I think that literature, fiction, can sometimes get closer to the truth of what's happening in society than spot news coverage, or even, you know, essays written about things that are happening as the days go by. So that was really my motivation. One, personal, that I really like to write, wanted to try to write fiction and think that I can do it. And secondly, to try to get at some truths that are not as perhaps easily, it's never easy to get to the truth. Of course, truth is an ideal only to be approached. But it's easier in some ways to, or you can do it more, I think, with more richness in fiction than you can, let's say, in journalism. That's a long answer to your question.
Well, that's okay. You answered the question very fully and dynamically, as usual. And what were the issues that addled?
Well, I think, you know, and the main characters in the novel are journalists, and they, you know, are experiencing, especially the first, the main first female character, is experiencing what I think a lot of us in the business have felt, which is, again, the sense of frustration in terms of covering trauma, mass public trauma. Like this character spent some time in covering the Yazidi genocide in Iraq and other war stories. And I know a lot of war correspondents. I'm not one, but I think that as somebody who has occasionally covered like these types of conflicts, it's extremely frustrating to be witnessing horrible things and then realize like that you've just told everybody about this, you've been the witness, but that actually nothing happens. No change occurs. No gun regulations come in after somebody covers a school shooting, which I've done once in my life and will never do again. And no change comes when you're covering something like a genocide, you know, with the Yazidis or today in occupied Gaza. So I think that there's that part, that's part of the sort of addling. And then the other is just the sense of time, the events, this march of events, where what, you know, we have sort of watched, especially with the rise of Trump and MAGA, is this sort of what Steve Bannon, his strategist would say. I don't know if I can use this word on the radio, but, he would say, you know, flood the zone with S.
Okay, we get it.
S-S-S-S-T. And then that's how you win, because the journalists and the public really can't keep up with what's going on. So with the Trump administration, as a political reporter early on, we realized like every day there were like five things happening or being revealed to be happening in the Trump administration or around his coterie, which in normal times, each one of those things would have involved massive investigative power by the journalists, because they were so obviously out of line with the norms and with legal, you know, even legal behavior, that in normal times, people would be winning Pulitzers for like just covering one of those things. And you didn't have time to do that. So it's sort of this sense of, like I say, like in an old movie where you have the calendar flipping or the clock going fast because they're trying to show like now it's a new day or 2 years passed. And that's the sort of feeling that you have and we had and I certainly had and I met characters are having of like in their minds, like things are just moving so fast. So that's part of it. But the real takeaway for me is this, you know, the mystery of, you know, this dark this black hole of evil behind some of these mass shootings. And I open it with the Vegas, the worst mass shooting in American history, which, you know, it came and went and we don't understand like who that guy was and we never will. So, but what you have is, and if you go and Google it right now, you have huge numbers of conspiracy theories about what that was and who that guy was, because he maybe worked for the U.S. government at some point. He may have been a Democrat. He may have been a Republican. So there's this constant like churning of suspicion and you see it with the Trump assassination attempt where, you know, if you just go on any of the social media accounts and of like the right wing, you see just thousands of people speculating about, you know, how the CIA was involved in the FBI. So what I'm doing with this novel, this short novel, is these three people are facing this like avalanche of deliberate disinformation that was applied by people in the administration related to that particular event. And it's not, I'm inventing it. They didn't do this, but the administration was using, and, you know, the political uses of public trauma is something that we've seen quite often. And it's happening all the time, actually. And so that's what the book, that's the sort of theme of the book. But then, you know, the characters, I hope, are interesting. I've gotten some really good feedback. People are like, what happens next? Because it ends kind of on a cliffhanger. I'm not going to give it away, but I have a follow-up. It's a part of a trilogy, and the second novel I have about, 80% written, and it'll come out soon.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Nina Burley, the New York Times bestselling author of 7 acclaimed works of creative nonfiction. Her debut novel is Zero Visibility Possible, a dark satire about disinformation and the media, joined by culture reporter Valerie Manzi.
Okay. Nina, how did you come to name the book, the title?
Well, I was working in New Mexico. I had a 2-month sabbatical kind of writer fellowship thing there at a university in southern New Mexico. And those are road signs. There are road signs that say that all over New Mexico, and zero visibility possible. I just found it so, there's such strange things to see on the roads. And what they refer to is the possibility of a dust storm. Usually they're in like canyons or between mountain ranges. And I guess zero visibility is possible when you get a dust storm. But I think it's also a great metaphor for, kind of what is happening in our, public life, and especially politics, and especially these kinds of mass traumas.
And what do you hope a reader will learn from this or understand more fully? Because there is a lot to learn as I'm reading the book.
Oh, boy. I don't know if I would use the word learn. I don't know how to describe like what. I wrote it because I wanted to explain something that I understand and feel about kind of public life, public policy, politics in the United States, journalism, and our culture generally, in this period of huge technological advance and change and suspicion about people's motives and distrust. And I guess I just want people to take away a sense of how dystopic times affect people's inner lives. And I guess the takeaway is that you're like not alone feeling really confused, and that it's a snapshot of our moment. And I think with my Substack, which is basically a weekly rant about like MAGA weirdness, and have been writing it for about a year. I'm surprised at how many people are following. They started subscribing right away, and I thought, I don't know why people are subscribing. Like, I can't believe they're subscribing to this, because it's really just a kind of a personal venting spot. And I've come to understand that I think people feel a sense of comradeship or camaraderie or comfort when they see my writing, because they feel like, oh, I'm not alone thinking that way, and I'm expressing it in a way that I hope is entertaining and enlightening. And I think I did with this particular piece of work. I got a great compliment from an artist friend of mine who read it and said, it's like the writing is so distilled and crisp that it's like a cold shot of a spirit, like a cold drink of a cold martini or something. And that made me feel good, because I rewrite a lot. All writing is rewriting. My first drafts are always a mess, and I rewrote it, and I ratcheted it down so that the writing is very tight and the sentences are not long and rambling, and it's a short novel, because I think people need. We're all into speed and like, so this is a 50,000 word book, which is about 150 pages long, short, small book. And I think, I feel proud that I was able to bring the writing to the level that it's at.
Well, you certainly did a wonderful job as I read your book. And let's not forget that tonight at the Blue Fox, you will be having a reading of your book at 5:30 in Blue Fox in Narrowsburg.
Yes, please come. All listeners are invited. There will be cocktails, and there will be some books for sale, and some of the proceeds are going to Evergreen Meadows, this project for that's going to be a care place for traumatized teen girls in our community. So please come. There's some. There'll be little drinks, little food. The Blue Fox down on Narrow, just about 5 miles south of Narrowsburg on 97. Terrific little restaurant, and they even have a swimming pool. So
it's hot. Okay. Well, we'll bring our bathing suits.
Nina, please do. Yeah.
Nina, thank you so much. There's more about Nina and all of her great work at ninaburley.com and the American Freak Show Substack, AmericanFreakShow.news. We've got to run, but I know you're heading off to the DNC in Chicago.
Yes,
I am. Chicago is my hometown. I'm absolutely thrilled to be leaving. I'll be flying out there Monday, and I'm lining up credentials through the New York State delegation, hopefully. And I plan to be, I think, writing dispatches on the Freak Show every day.
Well, we might have to check in with you and see how it's going. So, Nina Burley,
I will happily give you an update.
Oh, great.
Okay.
From the ground.
Live on the scene. Thank you so much, Nina.
Absolutely.
And have a good event tonight.
You're welcome.
You being here.
Thank you both.
Thank you. We'll take a break. And when we come back, Canal Fest is this weekend in Wayne County. Thanks, Val.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
For hundreds of years, the British Navy and the British Army forced young men to serve, sometimes dragging them from their beds and from their families. The press gang took them. Next time on The Waggoner and Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, on Radio Catskill, we hear songs about the press gang. Join me, please, on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. The Wayne County Historical Society has the 11th Annual Canal Festival coming up this Saturday, August 17th from 10 to 4. It's at the Society's 17-acre D&H Canal Park at Lock 31 near Hawley. Here to tell us more is Tom Colbert, Wayne County Historical Society and D&H Canal Park Committee Chair. Tom, good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
What can folks expect during the Canal Festival, some of the demonstrations that are going to be on offer?
Well, we have a blacksmith that will be demonstrating. He's from Gravity Forge. We have wood carvers by Cherry Ridge Wood Carvers. We have outdoor skills by Ed and Jeff Bergholzer. We'll have fly casting demonstrations by Wayne Pike Trout Unlimited. There'll be fiber art displays and an archaeological dig in the canal bed. And we'll have Civil War reenactors encamped there.
You got it all, including guided tours along the towpath and exploring the canal's history.
That's correct.
And what about music and stuff for the kids? What else is going on there?
Well, the music, we start out, we have Ann and Mike Baglione, and then in the afternoon we have the band Poison Love, and we have a on the living stage we have Dave Matsinko, who's a folk singer, folk musician, and then Frank Little Bear and the Red Vision Native American Dance Team will be performing at several times during the day.
So you've got stuff all day from 10 to 4. And again, that is at D&H Canal Park, Lock 31, which is on the Texas Palmyra Highway in Hawley. You know, this is the 11th Annual Canal Festival. What is it you like to have folks learn about the D&H Canal and the history of the whole area there?
Well, just how incredibly amazing this engineering project was for that time period. And we have a full full-size replica canal boat to give the public the sense of the scale of these boats. You know, there were up to 1,300 of them on the canal in a season. And going through 108 locks, 108 miles, and all this stonework that the Irish laid, you know, it's just phenomenal. And the one thing this year we're going to have is the Pennsylvania Woodmobile. And it's a traveling exhibit of the forests of Pennsylvania and the trees that grow in the forest and how that shaped state history. And anyway, it's really interesting.
Yeah, there is so, it's, as you said, an engineering feat, really miraculous what folks did at that time with this D&H canal. And also, any of the other folks that are you're working with that you want to shout out?
Who I'm working with? Well, there's all these volunteers that are, you know, it takes about 40 volunteers to pull this thing off. But Sally Talaga is, she's prime. She's going to be giving a tour of the newly restored Daniels Farmhouse. There are three tours, and you'll have to sign up for those.
All right. And where can folks get more information?
You can get it at our website, WayneHistoryPA.com. Sorry, WayneHistoryPA.com.
WayneHistoryPA. You guys are preserving all the history there in Wayne County. We've been talking to Tom Colbert from the Wayne County Historical Society, and he's the committee chair of the D&H Canal Park, about the upcoming 11th annual Canal Fest. That is going to be Saturday, 10 to 4. They're in Holly at the D&H Canal Park at Lock 31. Tom, thank you so much for joining us, and have a great festival.
Thank you, and it's rain or shine.
Rain or shine, you got it. All right. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Before we go, a reminder that later today we have an event, a free planned giving event called Your Sound Legacy. It's presented in association with the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance and Growing Older Together. Learn more about planned giving, which is a charitable gift you decide to make as part of your philanthropic or estate plans. Featured speakers include Brian Rourke and Nancy Esposito of Rourke Law, Philip Coombe and Catherine Coombe of Coombe Bender & Company, and Elizabeth Rowley from the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan. That is today at 4. There's no cost for entry. We'll have some complimentary wine and hors d'oeuvres as well. So come down to Piccolo Paese at the Sullivan County Golf Club, just down the road from us here on Route 52 in Liberty. We do ask that you RSVP. So either call Mimi in the office at 845-482-4141 or email Mimi at wjffradio.org to reserve your spot for the free planned giving event today, Your Sound Legacy. That'll do it for us today. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Jeff Bank, Sullivan County's community bank, celebrating 110 years of service this year, offering deposit and loan products for all your banking needs. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender. National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry Identification Number 405318. Jeff Bank. Still banking strong. And support comes from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Callison Stratton, a singer-songwriter, public historian, and host of Liberation Station here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Liberation Station is a show that highlights the work of female and femme-presenting performers across genre and time. It's my little way of balancing the scales of representation on the radio. Join me for Liberation Station every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Can two people with different political beliefs still have a meaningful conversation? I'm Ronald Kelson, and I'm working with Radio Catskill on StoryCorps' One Small Step, bringing strangers and our community together, one conversation at a time. We are having conversations in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania all year long, and you should be a part of it. Sign up now at WJFFradio.org.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, sunny to partly cloudy. There could be a stray thundershower in parts of the area this afternoon. And some wildfire smoke from up north will cause some hazy conditions in sky, high of 80. Tonight, clear, low of 58. Looking ahead to the weekend, tomorrow, some clouds and some sun mixed, high 83, and then rain back in the forecast. Saturday, a shower and thunderstorm, and then on Sunday, some heavy rain and thunderstorms from Sunday morning into Sunday night. Some will be slow moving and bring some heavy rain to our area on Sunday. This is Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill, WJFF Jeffersonville. Listen local.